scientists who study neural representations of habits. Cues in the environment become the triggers of predictable and automatic actions. When it comes to food, we are, in essence, following an eating script that has been written into the circuits of our brains. Habits permit living creatures, both those with highly developed brains and those with less developed brains, to act quickly in response to routine events. This can be convenient, allowing us to do something without the need to pay close attention. We can tie our shoelaces and still hold a conversation. But that convenience comes at a price. The brain architecture making it possible allows us to act without awareness, not fully in control of our actions. In fact, that loss of control is the whole point. Loss of control is the effective strengthening of this habitual system, Joshua Burke said. A habit is a way of saving cognitive effort. It makes sense to have a system that, when faced with the same situation over and over, allows a fixed response without having to think about it. Habits are learned slowly, but once they're in place, they are by their very nature difficult to break. One defining feature of habits is that they are resistant to extinction, said Burke. Habits are very inflexible. They're very unresponsive when a situation changes. The distinction between behavior driven by a goal and behavior driven by habit is demonstrated well by another study of high-sugar food. For a week, researchers placed sucrose pellets at the end of a runway, and a group of animals ran to eat them at the first opportunity. The animals were then moved to another room, where they again ate sucrose pellets in large quantities, but this time they were deliberately made ill when their meal was over. When they returned to the runway the next day, their behavior looked markedly different. Instead of running toward the food, they ambled in that direction and showed little interest in eating it. Contrast that with the results after a longer exposure. In the next round of experiments, animals had 3 weeks, rather than one, in which to eat the sucrose pellets at the end of the runway. Everything else stayed the same. After the 3-week test period, they were again offered large quantities of sucrose pellets and again made ill. Back on the runway the next day, their behavior was no different than it had been before they became sick. The animals again ran vigorously toward the food and put it in their mouths. It's a nice illustration of the difference between motivational behavior and habit, said Burke. After a single week's exposure, the association of the food with illness had stripped away the animal's motivation to eat more. But after 3 weeks, habit set in, and the animals acted without awareness. The outcome, eating food that had once made them ill, was no longer a deterrent to repeated motor activity. That's an experience familiar to people as well, including me. In the past, eating too much pizza has made me feel ill, but that did not prevent me from eating it again. The more rewarding the food, the stronger the learning experience that creates the automatic behavior. That's the danger of habit. But habit formation has the potential for good as well. If we can learn to turn all of this around, we can eventually create new habits, ones that motivate us to pursue other, healthier sources of reward.
Part 2. The Food Industry. Chapter 14. A Visit to Chili's.
Years of research had educated me about how sugar, fat, and salt change the brain. I understood some of the parallels between hyperpalatable foods and drugs of abuse, and about the links among sensory stimulation, cues, and memory. I'd met enough people like Claudia and Maria to understand how even the thought of food could cause them to lose control. But I wasn't fully prepared for the discoveries I made about irresistibility and whoosh, the monster thick burger and baked Cheetos flaming hot, about indulgence and purple cows. Without necessarily understanding the underlying science, the food industry has discovered what sells. I was sitting at Chili's Grill and Bar in Chicago's O'Hare Airport, waiting for a late-night flight. At a nearby table, a couple in their early 40s was deep into a meal. The woman was overweight, with about 180 pounds on her 5-foot-4-inch frame. The Southwestern egg rolls she had ordered were listed as a starter course, but the enormous platter in front of her had been heaped with food. The dish was described on the menu as smoked chicken, black beans, corn, jalapeno jack cheese, red peppers, and spinach wrapped inside a crispy flour tortilla, and it was served with a creamy avocado ranch dipping sauce. Despite its name, the dish looked more like a burrito than an egg roll, an only-in-America fusion approach. I watched as the woman attacked her food with vigor and speed. She held the egg roll in one hand, dunked it into the sauce, and brought it to her mouth while using the fork in her other hand to scoop up more sauce. Occasionally, she reached over and speared some of her companion's French fries. The woman ate steadily, working her way around the plate with scant pause for conversation or rest. When she finally paused, only a little lettuce was left. Had she known someone was watching her, I'm sure she would have eaten differently. Had she been asked to describe what she had just eaten, she probably would have substantially underestimated her consumption, and she would probably have been surprised to learn what the ingredients in her meal really were. The woman might have been interested in how my industry source, who had called sugar, fat, and salt the three points of the compass, described her entree. Deep frying the tortilla drives down its water content from 40% to about 5% and replaces the rest with fat. The tortilla is really going to absorb a lot of fat, he said. It looks like an egg roll is supposed to look, which is crispy and brown on the outside. The food consultant read through other ingredients on the label, keeping up a running commentary as he did. Cooked white meat chicken, binder added, smoke flavor. People like smoky flavor. It's the caveman in them. There's green stuff in there, he said, noting the spinach. That makes me feel like I'm eating something healthy. Shredded Monterey Jack cheese. The increase in per capita consumption of cheese is off the chart. The hot peppers, he said, add a little spice, but not too much to kill everything else off. He believed the chicken had been chopped and formed, much like a meatloaf, with binders added, which makes those calories easy to swallow. Ingredients that hold moisture, including autolyzed yeast extract, sodium phosphate, and soy protein concentrate, further soften the food. I noticed that salt appeared 8 times on the label and that sweeteners were there 5 times in the form of corn syrup solids, molasses, honey, brown sugar, and sugar. This is highly processed? I asked. Absolutely, yes. All of this has been processed such that you can wolf it down fast, chopped up, and made ultra palatable. Very appealing looking, very high pleasure in the food, very high caloric density. Rules out all that stuff you have to chew. By eliminating the need to chew, modern food processing techniques allow us to eat faster. When you're eating these things, you've had 500, 600, 800, 900 calories before you know it, said the consultant. Literally, before you know it. Refined food simply melts in the mouth. With more than 1,400 locations and $3.2 million in sales per restaurant in 2007, Chili's has been immensely popular. I visited the chain's restaurants in perhaps 12 different settings, many of them more than once. Often the restaurant was full, and sometimes crowds clustered at the front door waiting for tables. At a Chili's north of the Golden Gate Bridge, I ordered Kickin' Jack nachos, which were a featured appetizer, and 2 entrees, boneless Shanghai wings and margarita grilled chicken, for myself and a colleague. First, the Kickin' Jack nachos. The plate was artfully presented, with the chips arranged in a circle surrounding a colorful chopped salad, topped with a mound of pico de gallo salsa and another mound of sour cream. A slice of jalapeno pepper rested in the center of every chip. Marketed with the tagline, "Live a little," the Kickin' Jacks are a variation on the chain's classic nachos. The fried corn chip serves as the carrier for a layer of mashed black beans and a layer of zesty Monterey Jack cheese. There's more cheese in the Kickin' Jack nachos than in the classic version. A margarita spice mix gives them extra kick. Next, boneless Shanghai wings. As described on the menu, these were crispy breaded chicken breast topped with sweet and spicy ginger citrus sauce and sesame seeds, served with spicy cool wasabi ranch dressing for dipping. A dozen fat and textured chicken nuggets were set down in front of me. They looked great, and had flavor to match. Finally, margarita grilled chicken. We start with tender, juicy chicken breast, marinate it with our classic margarita flavoring, and grill it to perfection, according to the menu. The dish is served with rice, black beans, strips of fried tortilla, and salsa. My dinner companion seemed to think it was relatively healthy. Like the other dishes, it's artistically presented. A crosshatch of grill marks blackens both sides of the large boneless breast, which sits atop accompaniments of contrasting colors and textures. The uncooked chicken had been in a marinade that combined orange juice, tequila, triple sec, sweet and sour mix, and artificial color, thereby including sugar, two kinds of oil, and salt. It was shipped frozen in 25-pound bags, each containing about 50 pieces of meat, plus whey protein concentrate and modified tapioca starch. Nick Nicholson, a chief scientist at the Dallas-based Standard Meat, a supplier to Chili's, said that the chicken and marinade were tumbled together in a piece of equipment that resembled a cement mixer. "It pulls the marinade into the muscle," said Nicholson, breaking down the cellular structure of the meat and tenderizing it in the process. Another common way to get marinade into meat is through needle injection. Hundreds of needles are used to pierce the meat, tearing up the connective tissue. "It's been pre-chewed," said Billy Rosenthal, former president of Standard Meat. For all that, very little in the appearance or flavor of Chili's food suggests how much sugar, fat, or salt it contains, or how easily it goes down. A woman sitting near me eating nachos finished about two-thirds of her portion and then pushed her plate to the far side of her table. A few seconds later, she reached over and began to nibble again. Every time I ordered food at a Chili's, I casually asked the server, "What's in this?" Sometimes I asked the same question of the manager. I never asked for the recipe. I knew that was proprietary information. I didn't care what spices and seasonings were used, but I did want to know the major ingredients in the food I was ordering. As a consumer, I thought it was reasonable to find out what I was going to eat. Staff were generally reluctant to answer my question. "We can't tell you," one manager said flatly. "What are you concerned about?" asked the server. "What are your allergies?" "I'm not sure I'm allowed to say," someone else said hesitantly. Whatever the ingredients, my food consultant contact seemed to understand why some foods just slide down the throat. About the boneless Shanghai wings, he said, "Taking it off the bone is like taking the husk off the nut. That processing step reduces the need for chewing, making the food faster to consume." Those wings contain a solution of up to 25% water, hydrolyzed soy protein, salt, and sodium phosphate. The water is in there for several reasons. First, it bulks up the chicken. The industry calls this reducing shrinkage. Second, water is cheaper than chicken breast, so it's less costly to produce. And finally, water makes the food softer and chewing easier. Before the chicken is shipped from the manufacturing plant, it's battered, breaded, pre-dusted, and frozen. This creates a salty coating that becomes crispy when fried in fat. All this stuff absorbs fat, dries out this batter and breading, and replaces water with oil. So now you've got batter and breading that is probably 40% fat, according to the food consultant. The crispy coating, which also contains corn syrup solids, dried yeast, and soybean oil, may represent up to half the volume of the nuggets on the plate. Boxes containing 8 4-pound bags of ginger citrus sauce, each with a refrigerated shelf life of about 4 months, are shipped to Chili's restaurants to accompany the chicken. The ingredients in the sauce sound relatively benign. Sugar, hoisin sauce, vinegar, soy sauce, garlic, chili paste, modified food starch, and orange juice concentrate. But sugar is the dominant nutrient, and salt is listed 3 times. "The ginger citrus sauce introduces syrupy, sweet, clingy stuff," said the consultant. "Sugar on sugar, really just different sugars, and lots of salt, and lots of intense flavor. The hoisin sauce contributes saltiness and a browning effect, while the orange juice concentrate adds a tangy fruit flavor." Apparently, Chili's considers all of this insufficiently enticing. Accompanying the fried and sweetened chicken concoction is a wasabi ranch dressing, which is made from mayonnaise, buttermilk, spices, and wasabi powder, and has a pleasantly sharp bite. Wasabi has kind of a cool green look to it, and people love creamy, said the consultant. The most popular salad dressings are creamy, he added. The most popular soups are creamy. The wings are served in a basket lined with waxed paper and bits of strange-looking crispy noodles that absorb excess fat. How sensory is the meal? I asked. It's the quintessential example of how to cram as much hedonics as you can into one dish, he answered. The needle on his three-point compass must have been gyrating wildly. Like most chain restaurants in America, Chili's serves hyper-palatable food that requires little chewing and goes down easily.
Chapter 15. Cinnabon, a lesson in irresistibility.
The Cinnabon story began in a farmhouse in Snohomish, Washington, 35 miles outside Seattle, where family and friends once gathered for legendary Sunday dinners of fried chicken, baked beans, and cinnamon rolls. A woman named Geraldine Brousseau recalled the spirit of those occasions vividly. This was her grandmother's house, and she remembered the love her grandmother poured into those cinnamon rolls and the eager delight in the eyes of guests who were about to eat them. An avid cook herself, Brousseau eventually opened her own French-style bakery and cafe. She had envisioned a sophisticated place that would serve handcrafted croissants, quiches, and pastries, but her family insisted that her grandmother's country-style cinnamon rolls be included on the menu as well. The cafe quickly gained renown for its luscious cinnamon rolls, and people traveled great distances to sample them. The New York Times wrote about those irresistible cinnamon rolls, and then, one day, in 1985, the phone rang. Rich Coleman was on the line. Coleman is the founder of Restaurants Unlimited, which today owns about 30 American-style restaurants, including steakhouses, grills, and fish houses. Geraldine, I have an idea, he said. How would you like to make the world's greatest cinnamon rolls? You bet, Brousseau replied. Cinnabon was a marriage of Brousseau's culinary prowess and Coleman's vision of small bakeries selling fresh, warm cinnamon rolls in shopping malls, airports, and other easy-to-find places around the country. The signature product was developed in a test kitchen where Brousseau and Coleman worked obsessively on every detail. We began to create together the language for the quality and characteristics we wanted, said Brousseau. We started from the outside in. We wanted it to look this certain way. We wanted it to be voluptuous and full and round and have many, many wraps. We wanted it to be aromatic in a certain way, pungent, and so appealing that people couldn't resist it. We wanted a dough that had a quality like a pillow, a dough that would be soft. And then the syrup, the cinnamon caramel in the center would be very soft and syrupy, so there would be this contrast of textures. They also envisioned a creamy topping. We wanted this creaminess, a cream that would actually be spooned over the top of the rolls that would just add to this indulgent quality. Brousseau and Coleman were consumed by the quest for the finest and freshest ingredients available. They consulted with spice experts who schooled them in the qualities of cinnamons grown all over the world before settling on a bark from Sumatra. Later, Cinnabon used cinnamon from Vietnam as well. For months, the partners baked and sampled hundreds of cinnamon rolls, testing and cross-testing for different properties. Their special challenge was to design something that could be cooked in a convection oven so the rolls could be served warm within 30 minutes. They eventually succeeded in their quest to develop the roll they wanted, the one Brousseau said was very indulgent and absolutely irresistible. Cinnabon celebrated its 20th anniversary in 2005, with 600 bakeries worldwide. I wanted to identify the properties that make the world's greatest cinnamon rolls so irresistible. Brousseau warned that the answer did not lie only in the ingredients list. That, she said, didn't begin to convey the artistry or enticement of a cinnabon. What creates irresistibility is caring, attention, visual appeal, and the appeal of aroma, texture, and consistency, she explained. The taste is so fulfilling, It just has something that is yum. The cinnamon's fragrance and flavor and the memories it evokes are also important, she said. Cinnamon is a real carrier. There's something about it, an intrinsic warmth. I pushed her on the impact of some key ingredients. Wheat and yeast are the basics that will give me bread, I said. What's the next enhancement? Salt brings up the flavor, said Brousseau. What's next? Sugar. She explained why three different kinds are used. Granulated white sugar sweetens the dough and helps create its soft texture. Brown sugar in the sticky filling that runs to the center of the wrap gives a caramel flavoring, and powdered sugar in the frosting melts easily and adds a light, creamy consistency. Brousseau said fat was a further enhancement, giving the dough a certain elasticity and richness, and enriching the luscious brown sugar, cinnamon, syrupy, caramelly, gooey stuff inside. The cream cheese in the frosting gives it that really nice, creamy texture and contributes to the aroma that draws people in. Cinnamon, vanilla, and lemon add other flavor notes, and Brousseau said the warmth of the rolls is yet another essential element. Temperature creates this appeal. It heightens the aroma, it heightens the flavor, it heightens the whole sensory experience. What happens in my mouth when I eat this? I asked. First comes the cinnamon hit, she explained. Then a series of flavors and textures unfold as I bite into the pillowy dough and taste the sweet, slippery filling and the creamy frosting. It melts in your mouth. It disappears easily. The swallow is very nice, Brousseau said. It's amazing to me how much people love cinnamon. Given her professional interests and the extraordinary success of her signature product, I was somewhat surprised to learn how concerned Geraldine Brousseau is about childhood obesity. If someone today asked me to create the world's greatest cinnamon roll, I'd probably think differently about it, she said candidly. 20 years ago, it was a once-in-a-while indulgence. I wasn't so worried about obesity among kids. Now, I am. I'm very concerned that kids are growing up eating too many things, like cinnamon, every day of their lives. But she felt no need to apologize for her success. I make cinnamon rolls for my family for special events. I make cinnabuns for friends. I love to teach people about the lineage of cinnamon rolls, about this ordinary food made extraordinarily well so that you can really have a wonderful sensory experience. But I don't teach them to eat it 4 times a day. It's all a matter of balance. Balance was something Brousseau once lacked in her own life. In her 20s, 30s, and 40s, she battled bulimia and anorexia. A chef and restaurant operator who lived her days surrounded by tempting indulgences, there had been a time in her life when Brousseau lost all sense of when she was hungry and when she was full.
Chapter 16. That's Entertainment.
Pink's is a hot dog stand. Since its inception as a pushcart, it's been in the same Los Angeles location for more than 65 years, at the corner of Melrose and La Brea Streets. The food is legendary. The family-owned restaurant boasts photographs of hot dog-eating celebrities on its website, and it's earned a place of honor on Best of Los Angeles lists. When Pink's celebrated its 60th anniversary by selling hot dogs for 60 cents apiece, customers waited in line for 4 hours to get them. Among the 21 varieties available at Pink's are the Bacon Chili Cheese Dog, the Brooklyn Pastrami Swiss Cheese Dog, and the Three Dog Night Dog, three hot dogs wrapped in a giant tortilla and served with bacon, cheese, chili, and onions. I talked with Gloria Pink, whose in-laws, Paul and Betty, founded the operation, and asked how the business had changed over the years. It's all about entertaining people, she explained, emphasizing the importance of offering variety and special tastes. That's what the food business has become. Food as entertainment? I hadn't quite thought in those terms. Later, I learned that a more colloquial word is used in the food industry. Eatertainment. A framed photograph of a cheese and pepperoni pizza reinforced the idea that the industry has evolved to provide mass entertainment. I noticed the photo on my food industry source's office wall and asked him about it. It's visually very appealing, great taste, great texture, and mouthfeel. he said of the pizza's crispy crust, sauce, and savory toppings. Mentally, your mouth waters. I understood what he meant. I could almost smell the aroma of a pizza fresh from the oven as I looked at the photo. I could almost taste it. Most chain restaurants feature similar photographs, often prominently displayed on the menu, on table cards, or near the order counter, along with enticing written descriptions. The food industry understands exactly what it's doing when it markets foods with such compelling imagery, said my source. In the face of the pleasure that pizza promises, consumers suspend more rational thought and are drawn to the indulgence of it. The pleasure becomes a distraction, directing attention away from thoughts of a food's fat or caloric content. It's a very indulgent pizza, he said. Indulgent is a growing thing. The food consultant explained that Americans spend a relatively low percentage of their personal income on food, which makes it easy for them to upgrade to premium products, those that are most palatable, most indulgent, and not, incidentally, the most profitable for the industry. Indulgence is the primary driver in premium products, he said. Generally, they're higher in flavor and often higher in fat, and a lot of imagery goes with them. It's a very profitable place for the food and beverage industry. Purchasing indulgent food is an inexpensive form of entertainment, the consultant continued. You can indulge at any level, from the lowliest fast food emporium to the fanciest white tablecloth table service restaurant. In marketing indulgence, the industry knows something about us that we don't fully know about ourselves. It knows that when we walk into a restaurant, we're seeking much more than a satisfying meal. We are hoping for a respite from daily pressures, and restaurants cater to that with food, imagery, and atmosphere that keep us entertained. In a world where people often feel under stress, food is escape more and more, the consultant said. The more the food industry behaves like the entertainment industry, the more profitable it is. When everyone is competing for what the industry calls share of wallet, that's a powerful motivation. I turned to a venture capitalist who knows the food business intimately and has put a lot of money on the table to help it grow. He, too, talked about stress in contemporary society. Starbucks, he said, has recognized and responded brilliantly to a cultural need. The caffeine and sugar in the coffee, with their energizing effects, are certainly part of the equation, but the chain also offers something much more primal. It's about warm milk and a bottle, he told me. One of my colleagues said, if I could put a nipple on it, I'd be a multimillionaire. By encouraging us to consider any occasion for food an opportunity for pleasure and reward, the industry invites us to indulge a lot more often. That theme populates the marketing reports and conferences that drive food service decision-making. Self-indulgent treating fulfills a very important psychological function, declares one report. Indulging in a premium snack is a self-centered activity, a small moment of relaxation, of me time. One industry report, titled Profiting from Consumers' Desires for Healthy Indulgences, which sells for about $6,000, expands on this theme. Growing levels of stress create a need for indulgence and relaxation, declare the authors, who estimate that consumers spend billions of dollars on premium treating occasions. Other highlights from the report. Consumers are indulging themselves more often. A growing proportion of snacking occasions are premium. Self-rewarding encourages premium snacking. There's a growing feeling that people need to reward themselves. There's a blurring of distinction between needs and desires. The report went on to offer numerous ideas for exploiting these trends. Similar themes were sounded at a Chicago conference on restaurant trends sponsored by six food industry leaders, among them Heinz, PepsiCo, the National Pork Board, Smucker's, and Tyson. Here, too, the discussion focused on catering to consumers whose lives are increasingly harried. According to a survey conducted by the restaurant research firm Technomics, consumers are working longer hours and feeling more stress, and almost half of them say their personal responsibilities can be overwhelming, and they deserve to eat out at restaurants as often as they like. But as eating out becomes more routine, the restaurant experience risks becoming something less special. That means restaurateurs need to develop creative, new approaches if they are to gain what a Technomics speaker called a larger share of stomach. Conference speakers proposed a number of ways to do that. One was to expand takeout offerings. Consider takeout as an experience, not a transaction, advised one Technomics representative. That's why Boston Market advertises its ready-to-eat supermarket line made from craveable, chef-inspired recipes. It also explains Applebee's car-side-to-go service, with a special parking space and a dedicated server to hand-deliver each order, and Outback's curbside takeaway, which maintains in each of its more than 800 stores a staff of 3 workers who are dedicated exclusively to delivering food to waiting cars. "I don't even have to put on shoes," one satisfied Outback customer told a reporter. Another suggested strategy for gaining stomach share was creating a child-friendly environment. Among the tips for achieving that, dippables put fun back in food. Desserts offer an opportunity for creativity, and upgrades and add-ons provide increased check opportunities. The goal in each example is clear. Consumers feel compelled to indulge and entitled to do so. The key to a successful food business is to offer them the best opportunities for that.
Chapter 17, The Era of the Monster Thick Burger.
During the course of my research, food had begun to look different to me. I used to assume that when I ordered green beans at my neighborhood Japanese restaurant in San Francisco, I'd be getting a healthy plate of green vegetables. Now I realized I was more likely to be served beans that had been deep-fried in an oil-filled wok. United States Department of Agriculture data show that today we're eating more of everything. By far, the largest increase has been in the consumption of fats and oils, with a 63% jump over a 33-year period from per capita annual consumption of about 53 pounds to about 86 pounds. The use of sugars and sweeteners is also up by a modest 19%. And in that same period, we ate 43% more grain and 7% more meat, eggs, and nuts. USDA data also report that we're eating 24% more vegetables, which seems like good news, until you learn that a large component of those vegetables are deep-fried potatoes in the form of French fries. The ready availability of formerly scarce fats and sugars reflects centuries of change in agriculture and more recent developments in manufacturing, distribution, and government regulations. W. Philip T. James, an expert nutrition researcher and chairman of the International Obesity Task Force, offers an intriguing evolutionary perspective on the transformation of our food supply and our eating patterns over time. Early human diets contained only about 10% fat. Sugar intake, primarily from ripe fruit, was also modest. But these commodities were essential sources of the energy needed for survival, and we developed the biological tools to appreciate them when we could get them. That may be why we have 300 or more olfactory receptors to sense the odors associated with fats, as well as an innate preference for sweetness. An industrial and agricultural transformation after World War II led to a remarkable increase in animal protein and crop production and substantial increases in the availability of butter and vegetable oils, wrote James. The levels of fat and sugar in food today illustrate the industry's enthusiastic response to biological drives and commercial opportunities, he continued. It is little wonder that food manufacturers, responding to taste panels and sales returns, have focused, particularly in the last 2 decades, on providing this evolutionarily rare but highly prized sensory mix as a routine in an increasingly varied number of foods made for convenient consumption. Foods rich in combinations of sugar and fat are not entirely recent innovations, the grilled cheese sandwich and the milkshake or American standards, but hyper-palatable foods are much more the norm today than they were in the past. Take the creamy rock shrimp tempura at an upmarket Japanese restaurant in Manhattan. The shrimp was rolled in mayonnaise, fried in a sweetened tempura batter, then rolled again in spicy mayonnaise. That's fat on sugar, on fat, on fat. When I ordered dumplings with shrimp in a Peruvian restaurant, what arrived was more like a fried donut with fried cream cheese inside. Fat on sugar, on fat. The sizzling calamari salad, served as a starter at Chinois on Main, Wolfgang Puck's inventive Santa Monica restaurant, was a revelation. I sat at the counter where I could see into the open kitchen as it was prepared. Sizzling should have been my clue that the healthy-sounding dish was anything but. The chef threw breaded seafood into an enormous wok and deep-fried it in rice oil. I thought back to the food consultant's comment about salads that are really fat with a little lettuce. I ordered the innocent-sounding entree, Shanghai lobster with spicy ginger curry sauce and crispy spinach. After the chef opened the body of the lobster, I watched him pan-fry it face down in peanut oil while the spinach sizzled in an oily wok. After the lobster was fried, it was baked in the oven, and when it arrived at my table, nothing about its appearance revealed the amount of fat it contained. Little wonder that one contributor to Zagat wrote, "I will die happy if Shanghai lobster is my last meal." In Amherst, Massachusetts, a college crowd seeks out Antonio's Pizzas, which are offered with toppings like beef taco, potato and bacon, chicken quesadilla, and a blend of ground beef, pepperoni, sausage, bacon, and extra cheese. The barbecue steak burrito contains black beans, rice, sour cream, and cheddar cheese. Another student favorite was Fatso's, which featured an entree named Mac the Knife, a hamburger special topped with macaroni and cheese and eight different kinds of fries, including baked potato fries with ranch dressing, cheese, bacon, and onions. Sugar didn't dominate, although the food certainly had some, but all of the dishes were filled with salt on fat on salt on fat on salt on fat. The high-end dessert market is equally impressive in its commitment to sensory stimulation. Take Otis Spunkmeyer, which markets raw cookie dough that can be used by restaurants and cafes to make supreme indulgence cookies. Its double chunky chocolate dream uses both white and dark chocolate chunks. The cranberry white chocolate duo combines white chocolate chunks, sweetened dried cranberry halves, and molasses. Buttery pecan decadence and oatmeal cinnaraisin craven are two other choices that engage multiple senses. And of course, at the traditional fast food chains, which account for a sizable majority of the nation's $333 billion restaurant food industry, combinations of sugar, fat, and salt are ubiquitous. The bun of a McDonald's Big Mac contains not only the flour, water, and salt we expect in bread, but also high fructose corn syrup, soybean oil, canola oil, and partially hydrogenated soybean oil. There are plans to remove the partially hydrogenated oil, in line with a broader movement away from trans fats, but that won't transform the bun into health food. A breakfast sandwich from Burger King contains 4 eggs, 4 strips of bacon, and 4 slices of cheese. Pizza Hut offers a pizza with cheese baked into the crust. And consider these examples. At the Grand Lux Cafe in Las Vegas, double-baked mashed potatoes are wrapped in fried spring rolls and served with cheese and bacon. Listed as an appetizer, they come 8 to a serving. That's a simple carbohydrate loaded with fat, then surrounded by layers of salt on fat on salt on fat. One of the signature hamburgers at Hardee's is called the Monster Thick Burger, which famously contains 1,420 calories and 108 grams of fat. Bacon, cheese, and mayonnaise are layered on the burger, and the bun is buttered. The Monster Thick Burger is little more than fat on fat on salt on fat on salt on fat, all on a refined carbohydrate. The International House of Pancakes recently put a stuffed French toast combo on its menu. Cinnamon raisin French toast, made with eggs and milk, is stuffed with sweet cream cheese, smothered with powdered sugar, fruit topping, and whipped topping, and served with 2 eggs, hash brown potatoes, and a choice of 2 strips of bacon or 2 sausage links. Breaking it down, the French toast is a load of fat on fat on fat and sugar that's then layered with fat on sugar, and served with fat, salt, and fat. Food need not be fried to be high in fat, of course. Targeting the children's market, TGI Fridays invented the cup of dirt, chocolate pudding, crumbled Oreo cookies, and gummy worms. Fat on sugar on fat on sugar on sugar. And Starbucks offers a strawberries and cream frappuccino with whipped cream and 18 teaspoons of sugar. All in all, this drink contains more calories than a personal-sized pepperoni pizza and more sweetness than 6 scoops of ice cream. Yet even that pales in comparison to a slice of Claim Jumper's chocolate motherlode cake. 6 rich layers that have been featured on the Food Network as one of the most decadent desserts in the country. The man behind the counter told me it had 2,150 calories a slice. At a convention in New Orleans, a representative of Ellison Bakery helped me understand some of the broader industrial shifts that have occurred over time. Ellison started in a family garage in Fort Wayne, Indiana, as a one-man producer of baked goods that were resold to restaurants and grocers. In the early 1980s, the company took a step toward greater complexity, producing cookies for ice cream sandwiches and toppings designed to add a crunchier surface to cookies. The concept of add-ins grew in popularity over the next decade, and Ellison rode that trend. Today it produces a full range of so-called crunch and inclusion products, such as mini fudge cookies, mini chocolate chips, ginger snap pieces, and cinnamon graham squares that can be mixed into ice creams and candy for added texture and flavor. People are looking for indulgence, said the Ellison representative, repeating a theme that was becoming familiar to me. The company responds with products designed for, to use its own words, a special kick-it-up-a-notch effect. Knowing that it's not enough to simply hand customers a packet of sugar or a pat of butter, the restaurant industry has spent a great deal of time learning the most effective ways to incorporate the core ingredients of sugar, fat, and salt into its products. But the art of designing foods consumers prefer is much more complicated than simply combining 3 key ingredients. Gail Vance Seville, founder and president of Sensory Spectrum, probably knows as much as anyone in America about what consumers like to eat and why. I traveled to the suburbs of New Jersey to meet this food industry consultant at her company's headquarters. Until our first meeting, I'd never thought much about what occurs from the moment I put a forkful of food into my mouth until that bite is gone, from the first chew through the manipulation to the swallow. Seville has spent a lifetime thinking about every nuance of that process. Historically, food companies have worried about design deficits, the off notes that might turn a consumer away from a product. More recently, their focus has shifted to what draws people in. That's what Seville tries to understand as she works on what she refers to as the fuzzy front end of consumer desire. Her expertise is sensory stimulation and food, the multitude of ways all 5 human senses become engaged before, during, and after eating. Consumers like products that combine the right stimuli in an optimal fashion. Seville believes that understanding the discrete sensory properties of a food and how those properties work together in the mouth is critical to designing a food that will succeed in the marketplace. The sensory stimulation provoked by sugar, salt, and fat begins before we put food into our mouths and lasts after the food is gone, she said. It can begin with cues, such as a food's package or its presentation on the plate. An appealing smell invariably stimulates desire. Other sensory properties emerge with the first bite and continue as we manipulate the food in our mouths. The second and third bites can stimulate other senses, as does compressing the mass and eventually swallowing it. Seville told me we perceive some sensory characteristics with our eyes. You can look at a product and you can see the texture. You see if the surface is smooth or rough, whether or not it is grainy. Those visual texture attributes are indicators often of wholesomeness, freshness. What else produces the sensory hits we like? I asked. Caramelizing food, the process of browning starches, sugars, and proteins, helps do this, she said. Caramelization generates sweeter aromatics and gives food more impact, more volatiles. It's a flavor found in many of the foods we produce in this country. It's a key driver of liking? Absolutely. On a sweet product, it's often the number one driver. Tell me how fat engages the senses. Why does the industry add so much of it to food? One reason, she responded, is that fat contributes to texture in many ways, giving food body, crunch, creaminess, or contrast. Fat makes food feel thicker and richer and will contribute to a sense of fullness in the mouth. It also promotes the release of flavor-enhancing chemicals. Seville learned this in Paris, where she noticed that people were routinely buttering their brie cheese sandwiches. Her initial surprise quickly gave way to appreciation. "It tastes great," she said. "Butter helps the cheese actually develop in the mouth. It releases more flavor." Also, fat helps flavors merge and meld, creating a smooth sensation as it brings disparate ingredients together in a symphonic whole. Seville suggested the same simple experiment that Adam Drewnowski had conducted to illustrate the impact of fat on flavor. Add a teaspoon of high-quality vanilla extract to a cup of heavy cream and another to a cup of skim milk. The first concoction tastes rich and delicious, but the second tastes terrible. "Without fat," explained Seville, "the flavor notes do not develop in the same way. The physical chemistry is such that the volatiles are not released in the way that they're released in the fat." The lubricating properties of fat are also essential because with them, the product disappears much more rapidly. It absorbs saliva better, and it disappears. You have a quick getaway, a quick melt, she explained. Fat contributes to a smooth, even bolus, the wad that forms as you chew food, in the mouth. If fat is removed from a product, it won't break down the same way. Rather than melting, you get little tiny globs of stuff suspended in saliva, she said. Seville didn't have to add that this would make for an unpleasant sensory experience. "If it's meant to melt, it better melt," said Seville. "That is critical to the nature of the product. It's critical to the pleasure of the product." Fat also lingers after we swallow food, leaving flavor behind in the mouth. Unlike bad wine that just falls off, the volatility is still there, so you still have pleasurable aftertaste. By the end of my day with Seville, I understood that a vast number of sensory stimuli can be associated with a food. Flavor, aroma, oral texture, visual texture, manual texture, creaminess, firmness, ease of pour, crumbliness, melt, viscosity, tooth stick, mouth coating, particle size, springiness, compression, adhesiveness, moisture absorption, chalky film, gloss. Each of these qualities alone has an impact on the pleasure we derive from food, and combining particular attributes in an almost infinite number of possibilities has an even greater effect. My discussions with Gail Seville about sensory stimuli alerted me to what all that loading and layering really does. Those fat on sugar on fat on salt on fat combinations generate multiple sensory effects, which is just what the industry wants. Consider battered French fries, whose sensory properties include what Seville describes as a crystalline outer coating that makes them extra crispy. "And when bacon and cheese are added to those fries," I asked, "does that generate more sensory cues?" "Without a doubt," she confirmed, "adding more fat gives me more flavor. It gives me more salt. And that bacon gives me a lot more lubricity." That's where the appeal lies. We're eating for sensation. I was curious about which sensory properties make marketplace winners. The Snickers bar, according to Seville, is extraordinarily well engineered. "While its flavor characteristics are appealing," she said, "the real key to its success lies in its even disappearance and clean getaway. When you eat a Snickers bar, the chocolate, the caramel, the nougat, and the peanuts all disappear at the same time. You're not getting all this buildup of stuff in your mouth." That contrasts with many products whose nuts become annoyingly lodged between your teeth and your cheek. "The genius of Snickers," explained Seville, "is that as we chew, the sugar dissolves, the fat melts, and the caramel picks up the peanut pieces so the entire candy is carried out of the mouth at the same time." The kettle chip is another success story. Made from sugar-rich russet potatoes, kettles have a slightly bitter background note, and they brown irregularly, which gives them a complex flavor. High levels of fat generate easy mouth melt, and surface variations at a level of interest beyond what we typically find in mass-produced chips. Heightened complexity is the key to modern food design. French fries were once merely French fries before they were enhanced with bacon or cheese. A hamburger was once a hamburger, and eating it was what Saville called a single event. You didn't have it loaded up with 20 levels of stimulation creating this multi-layered event. We've shifted radically from the food norms of the past. Supermarket foods have changed too. Instead of buying potatoes in the produce section, we buy potato au gratin in a package. Some brands of pasta sauce are loaded with sugar. Foods from around the world are sold breaded, battered, and fried, appearing in the frozen foods section as chicken tacos and jalapeno poppers, calamari rings and fish sticks, stuffed pierogi and dumplings. And we don't have to buy plain frozen vegetables if we prefer to have them glazed or smothered in cheese and butter sauces. Take a look at cereal, said Saville. You used to get one thing. I mean, Raisin Bran was a big deal with two things in a box. She guessed that half of today's cereals have multiple ingredients added to the base flakes or nuggets. When I wandered the cereal aisle of my local supermarket, past Lucky Charms and Cocoa Puffs and Honey Nut Cheerios, I wondered whether that figure isn't higher. All of this has changed the nature of food. Simplicity has given way to elaborately structured products that give us more layers, more sensory cues, more sensory stimuli, Saville pointed out. And more sugar, fat, and salt, I asked. I'm sure of that. Scientists were as intrigued as industry about the multisensory effects of food. In the summer of 2006, I was in Naples, Florida, attending a scientific meeting sponsored by the Society for the Study of Ingestive Behavior. Early one morning, I heard a presentation by Richard Fulton of Columbia University's Department of Psychiatry, who was participating in a symposium entitled Basic and Clinical Science of Ingestion and Reward. I was at full attention as Fulton started talking about positive reinforcement or reward. Although the subject of the morning session was the pleasure we derive from food, he angled into that conversation by describing another set of stimuli, the combination of cocaine and heroin, known colloquially as speedball. Fulton spoke of the real rush people achieve, the roller coaster ride induced by ingesting substances with differing stimulating and sedating effects. You're going up, you're going down, it goes away, and then it comes back. It's just great. People who experience the complex pleasures of these alternating effects learn to manipulate them for the sensations they want, Fulton said. They like each component, and they like the mixtures they can achieve. They might use one stimulus several times and then top off that experience by consuming something else. The self-administration of two drugs in close proximity may increase the desired effect of one drug or both drugs or decrease an undesired effect, Fulton explained. Using a combination of drugs could also increase the duration of a desired effect or decrease the duration of an undesired one. Or, he added, the combination could produce an effect not available with either drug alone. I did not have to stretch to understand the analogy he was making to food. We top off an excessive meal with an indulgent dessert and seek the additive effects of an agreeable flavor combination, such as hot and sour or sweet and salty. We find pleasure in a mix of attributes, such as mouthfeel, temperature, texture, and viscosity. When we eat more ice cream because it has added chocolate chips, add creamy blue cheese dressing to fried chicken, or expect entertainment with a restaurant meal, we are in search of multisensory effects.
Chapter 18. No Satisfaction.
When we talk about the complexity of American foods, we aren't referring to the kind of complexity traditionally associated with fine cuisine or regional or ethnic cooking. The American concept of complexity is built on layering and loading rather than an intricate and subtle use of quality ingredients. Visitors from other cultures often remark on the difference. Yoshiyuki Fujishima, an executive at Ajinomoto, one of Japan's largest food companies, believes that American food is fundamentally less satisfying than Japanese food. The food I used to eat in Japan has complex flavor, and I can get satisfaction with less quantity, he said. By contrast, with American food, you have to have a lot to be satiated. Europeans say much the same thing. To more sophisticated palates, our cuisine lacks finesse. There's no curiosity in it. You're swamped with very strong tastes, one source told me. He called American food over the top. Where traditional cuisine is meant to satisfy, American industrial food is meant to stimulate. Our diet today is mostly made up of easy calories. According to Gail Seville, in the past, Americans typically chewed a mouthful of food as many as 25 times before it was ready to be swallowed. Now, the average American chews only 10 times. In part, this is because fat, which has become ubiquitous, is a lubricant. We don't eat as much lean meat, which requires more saliva to ready it for swallowing. We want something that's higher in fat, marbled, and so when you eat it, it melts in your mouth, said Seville. Food is easier to eat when it breaks down more quickly in the mouth. If I have fat in there, I just chew it up and whoosh, away it goes. John Haywood, a prominent restaurant concept designer, agreed. Processing, he said, creates a sort of adult baby food. By processing, he means removing the elements in whole food, like fiber and gristle, that are harder to chew and swallow. What results is food that doesn't require much effort to eat. It goes down very easy. You don't even think much about eating it, said Haywood. The food consultant who told me about his industry secrets had much the same perspective. We've gone through some kind of metamorphosis over the years. We've made food very easy to get calories from. He talked about the greater degree to which we refine foods now. An example is how we mill away the bran from brown rice and whole wheat flour. As a result, the food is light, it's white, it's very easy to swallow, it doesn't obstruct you in any way, it's easy to get a lot of calories without a lot of chewing. Because this kind of food disappears down our throat so quickly after the first bite, it readily overrides the body's signals that should tell us, I'm full. He offered coleslaw as an example. When its ingredients are chopped roughly, it requires time and energy to chew. But when cabbage and carrots are softened in a high-fat dressing, coleslaw ceases to be something with a lot of innate ability to satisfy. Contrast apples with applesauce, and we can see the same phenomenon. When the peel is removed, much of the fiber is lost. Then we add sugar to it. We make it so you can practically drink the thing. It doesn't ever provide the satiation of a fresh apple that you have to chew on. This isn't to say that the food industry wants us to stop chewing altogether. It knows we want to eat a donut, not drink it. What are you going to do with the sugar? Put it on your tongue? Asked the food consultant. I want to chew. I want to feel it in my mouth. The key for the food industry is to create foods with just enough chew, but not too much. Foods that go whoosh don't leave us with a sense of being well-fed. By stripping food of fiber, we also strip it of its capacity to satisfy. In making food disappear so swiftly, fat and sugar only leave us wanting more. Instead of paying attention to what goes into our mouths, we're engaged in a shoveling process, said Nancy Rodriguez. An expert on the sensory properties of food and head of the product development firm Food Marketing Support Services, Rodriguez asserts, we eat to be belly-filled.
Chapter 19, Giving Them What They Like.
Like most industries, the food industry doesn't merely design products and send them forth hoping consumers will buy them. It engages in an elaborate process of reverse engineering to figure out exactly what we'll like. They do the mathematics necessary to deconstruct the key drivers of liking, Gail Seville observed. The stakes are higher with food than with most other commercial products. Intentionally or not, industry activities take advantage of the biology of the brain, selling us products that alter our bodies. Success depends on creating a blueprint for producing foods with the right combination of sensory properties. Since some consumers prefer, say, sweeter or saltier foods, the mix of stimulating ingredients will depend to some degree on the target market. But in general, Seville said, industry is trying to find the formulation that is going to make the greatest number of people want it. This approach has been honed to a fine science. By the time he retired as Vice President for Research and Development at Nabisco, Robert Smith had established unassailable credentials in the food industry. On his watch, two enduring cookie success stories, Oreos and Chips Ahoy, had brought the company remarkable profits. Smith helped me see why. His message was that no single aspect of food, neither one ingredient nor one sensory property, gets us to like something. The quest in the industry is to find the combination of qualities that will do that. The key drivers are multisensory, said Smith. It's not just one thing. To identify a desirable mix of attributes, the industry assembles taste panels that allow consumers and professionals to dissect a given product's pleasing qualities. The industry calls this fingerprinting, and the technique is used to figure out what proportion of which elements will be acceptable to a consumer. We look at this model to determine what turns consumers on, he acknowledged. Smith had played a pivotal role in bringing fat-free Snackwell's cookies to market, which is what made me so eager to talk to him. I wanted to know why Snackwell's would not relinquish their grip on me. Time and again I'd eat one, walk away from the box, and return a few minutes later for another, and another, and another one after that. I didn't like my behavior, but I kept doing it anyway. Often, I didn't even realize how many cookies I'd eaten until they were all gone. Nabisco had encountered obstacles en route to getting a no-fat cookie onto supermarket shelves. Before it finally hit on the formula for commercial success, the company had to solve the problem of texture. Without fat, the cookie initially seemed harsh and dry. Snackwells were ready for the big time only after Nabisco discovered that a small amount of the fatty acid diglyceride was an adequate substitute. That discovery, along with a winning mix of ingredients and flavor notes, gave Nabisco a product that kept many of us coming back for more. You need to optimize the right combination, said Smith, again emphasizing the futility of focusing on isolated drivers of taste. If you simply maximize any one driver, you'll kill the product. It has to have all things together to make it a cookie. One necessary feature is consistency. The product has to taste the same every time a consumer buys it. A cookie also needs to look like a cookie. When Smith assembled his panels during the Snackwell's design process, he asked participants to make drawings of how they saw a cookie, knowing that a successful product would have to conform to conventional ideas about appropriate structure. How the mind sees it is very important, he said. It's the balance of all factors that drives hedonics. Providing contrast in a product is another way to maximize multisensory impact, as Oreo cookies demonstrate. Their appealing texture and mouthfeel are popular features.